Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it. Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, interviewing the brightest minds inside and outside higher education today. Of course, always with me by my side, never letting me get out of line, my amazing co-host, Liz. Liz, how are you today?
I'm doing amazing. Thank you so much, Joe. How are you?
Good, good. And I appreciate you giving me a call before this episode to tell me to keep myself in line. You know, I'm always taking direction from you. It's amazing to have you keeping me at my best.
And so you better stay in line, because you know you're going to be in trouble if you don't. So there we
That's
go
it.
With that.
Well, speaking of trouble, we have one heck of a guest today.
Good trouble, right?
Good trouble.
Hashtag good trouble.
Hashtag good trouble. That's the way to do it. Founder and CEO of Boss Capital Partners, Greg Shepherd, is with us today. Greg, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
No, it's amazing to have someone such as yourself and, you know, your ties and what's happening in private equity and money and how it moves and the businesses and tech, and we're going to get into all that. But before we do, always we like to ask our guests, how are you? How's your family? This is a very interesting time we live in, which we'll talk about, but how are you guys doing out there in your inner circle?
I'm doing great. My world is good.
So that's good. And so let me ask you this. Were you a world traveler that's been grounded now? Because, you know, you're on the move and with all the businesses that you touch, have you had to make some life adjustments at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing about 100 to 150, sometimes 200,000 miles of travel. When COVID happened, I had to cancel. Let me see. I had Tokyo, Hong Kong, Moscow, South Africa. There was three or four other ones, big trips that all had to get canceled because of Sweden. I can't remember them all, but there was a bunch of them that just got canceled, because
how
of the
you,
trip.
How do you deal with that? Because that's a really interesting thing. Mental health is such a big part of what we do in education, and as people have transitioned to work from home context in their businesses, and, you know, many people being laid off all across the country, you know, there's this resetting, if you will, of what life is going to look like, at least in the short term, medium term, maybe long term. We don't know. For travelers, we've talked to some that have traveled frequently. And you get into this groove, right? I used to travel. I traveled about 50% of the time for 14 years when I was in one of my roles. And I just got used to it. I was just used to being on the move. And when I stopped traveling, I almost went through this travel depression period where I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, totally.
What's it like for you?
You get used to it, right? You get used to, you know, you pack your bag on, you know, Sunday night, you leave Monday morning, you come back on Friday afternoon, and then you have your weekend, and then you do it again. And that was kind of the routine. And then you have the way you pack your bag and, you know, the routine before you get on the plane, when you get on the plane, when you work, when you don't work, you know, the food that you eat at different airports, you know, I mean, you get this whole thing, you know, you get it all down. And then all of a sudden, all of that stuff stops. And then you're like at home and you're trying to you got to go through a transition. For me, I definitely had to go through a transition. But I'm on the other side of that transition now, and I actually love it. I'm actually way, you know, I there's a lot of time that gets wasted just in transit to and from the airplane, let alone the time on the plane, you know, that you can now optimize. And it's different. You don't have the time that you used to have sitting and waiting for the plane or on the plane where you can work on your machine. But, you know, I can do that now, you know, outside looking at the ocean. So it's much better.
Well, it's funny, and Liz, you're going to laugh when I say this. What a lot of people who don't travel all the time, what they don't understand is when you do travel all of the time, you do get into this zone, this travel zone where you're like judging the line that's going to move the fastest, and you're looking at people wondering, yeah. you know, are there kids in this line? Are there family
yeah,
oh,
totally.
Strollers?
Yeah.
So I'm going to avoid that.
Or elderly line. People sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah,
you're
elderly,
like,
is there,
yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Right. And then when you check in, you know which lines to hit. So anyway, I headed somewhere with my wife before we had kids, and you know, you go up to the kiosk, I check in. I checked myself in. We had, you know, I had purchased the flights under my name. So I checked myself in. I grabbed my ticket and I took off and I just started walking towards the security. And she was left there, but she couldn't get into her account to check in. So I basically left her at the kiosk and I rounded the corner and I just hear my name being yelled, Joe, Joe. I'm like, oh, wow, I left my wife at the kiosk. It's this zone. Anyway, that's, I digress. But Greg, why don't you talk to us a little bit about Boss Capital Partners? What is Boss Capital Partners? What's your goal, and what kind of impact are you having out there right now?
So, well, I'll back up to go forward. So, I started. I came from a pretty poor family, so my siblings were adopted. I have all different nationalities, and so we didn't have very much, and I worked really hard and I started businesses when I was in high school. And then when I was about 19, I built my first real business. I think I was 22 when I sold the bank, which was the first thing. And then I've done 12 consecutive startups after that, most of them in the tech space, because once the internet came out, I was like, oh, this is my place. And so I built all those companies and, you know, won the 4 private equity awards for transactions between 250 and a billion. And
saw that.
Yeah, and I started doing all this stuff because what I really wanted to do was I wanted to spend some time focusing on figuring out how to build businesses more efficiently. And so I did this myself for like 25 years, and I became a scholar of all the what I call operating systems, so Sigma and Agile and 4DX and OGSM and OKRs and on and on and on and on, right? And all the different tools that they use across different disciplines. And I came up with this thing called BOSS, which stands for the Business Operating Support System. And the idea was BOSS is to make it more efficient, faster, and easier to build and scale and sell a business. And I got down to the point where I could build and sell a business in less than 3 years. And so I sold a company to eBay. And when that happened, I kind of hit a level where I felt like it would be, you know, I was able to take care of my family and do some philanthropy, but I felt like I really wanted to help. So I went in and I started getting into politics. For like 3 years, I worked in politics and I was a chairman for senators and Congress people. And I got to meet
That's
Barack Obama, and it was freaking awesome to meet Barack Obama. It was like one of the most amazing things in my whole life. And I used BOSS there. Yeah. And I used BOSS there, you know, and then I was speaking at something, and then, you know, this publisher came up and said, hey, you should write a book about this. So I said, well, you know, I don't know how to write a book. And they said, well, listen, you know, there's a whole team around you. And then I got the Forbes book deal. And then I've been writing articles the whole time. I've written 100 articles for 29 different publications and speaking on it and stuff. And the whole motivation that I had when I went into politics was to try to contribute, specifically the wealth distribution, right? So to help this inequality of wealth across multiple different levels, right? You could go women, you could go ethnic, you could go immigrants, anywhere, right? It's across everywhere. And, you know, the 1% is 1%. People can't argue with that because facts are facts. And so I was like, there has to be a way that I can use capitalism for altruistic purposes. And then I came up with this term, altruistic capitalism, and I wrote an article and put it into Forbes. And then I started getting interest from universities. They were like, tell me about this BOSS thing. So I started teaching BOSS to entrepreneurs and accelerators and doing lectures at universities and all this stuff. And then I said, well, why don't I actually formalize this and then start giving it away? Because the epiphany I had, I was sitting at the beach meditating, and the epiphany I had is I said 90% of startups fail. Like, that's insane, right? That should not be acceptable, right? It's just, and nobody's doing anything about it. In fact, they're doing the opposite. All the investors are just saying, oh, okay, well, that's just risk management. You know, let's mitigate risk. And so they weren't fixing the root of the problem. But so what I did is I went out and studied. And I did 1,200 interviews with entrepreneurs, succeeding, failing investors. I interviewed the Navy SEALs, captains of the Air Force, the CIA. I mean, you know, just, you know, it goes fire departments, police departments, you know, just pretty much everything I could possibly interview that had processes that if those processes weren't followed, it was catastrophe. And I felt like if a business failed, that would be catastrophe. Because these entrepreneurs put their life and blood into this stuff. And for a lot of people like me, as an example, I couldn't make it in corporate. I had to build businesses to succeed. And, you know, because you couldn't afford to go to college. You couldn't, there's just no money, right? So you create your own destiny. And so that's what I decided to do. As a result of that, sorry, long-winded answer to your question, but as a long result of that, we started getting all these deals. And I said, well, you know, some of these I want to fund. So I started Boss Capital, a syndicate with a bunch of investors that had invested in my stuff in the past. And, you know, obviously they were successful 100% of the time. And then I started Boss Capital to start investing in startups at Series C. And that's, you know, and every investment gets trained on Boss. And then Boss, again, the business operating support system, is now spinning off into its own academy that's going to be taught by certified trainers at universities and accelerators.
I was taking some notes and listening because this is really fascinating to me, this idea of inequity and the idea of how do we shrink that wealth gap. And as we know, and Greg alluded to this idea of, as far as social justice and as far as finding ways to make a difference, we do see a lot of these marginalized communities, whether we're thinking about women, whether we're thinking about immigrants, whether we're thinking about people of color, Black, whatever the case may be, we're seeing that it becomes almost insurmountable in some instances for that wealth gap to be shrunk, I guess would be the right word, enough in order for them to make that generational change and in order to make a difference. How do we do that? How do we address that in meaningful ways in terms of how we can address those issues as a country? I think about this, maybe like yourself, I meditate and I think about how there has been over, you know, the past decades, there just has not been enough done to address those. It sounds like you went into politics and you've looked at how you can do it from the financial aspects of it. We're seeing, I looked at some recent statistics, more and more women, especially Black women, are starting their own businesses, but then still seeing that they're not able to get the funding. And like you said, there's this idea of even if you do get the funding, that a lot of times the businesses themselves are still not able to be successful enough to stay in business and maintain that long-term, that longevity that allows them to be successful over the long term. What are some of the things that you've observed? You've been very successful in this space. What can be done in practical terms that will make a difference for people?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there is a system that's already in place to incubate entrepreneurs, right? So people, visionaries, people with an idea that they think they can make happen. The problem is that there is no process or educational system around that, right? The universities are trying, you know, but universities are only good for the people that can afford to go to the university. And so there's, you know, very little available unless you scrape and try to put it together like I did. And so my objective is, if you know, to produce this business operating support system that addresses the five reasons why businesses fail and allow people to adopt it. It's supposed to be like an open source software, where for the last 5 years, what I've done is I've released it to the wild and I say, hey, use it. If you have a better way of doing something, let me know and I'll do an iteration like you would in agile software development. So I think that, you know, the reason why I decided to go this route is because when I was in politics, I couldn't do anything. I mean, you get a congressperson elected, and then they go to DC, and you know, you're basically
good
nothing
luck.
Happens, right? So
good luck, right?
Yeah. So yeah, and they change. You know, they do what's required in order to get them elected again, right? Because they're constantly interviewing for a job. Instead of doing their job, they're spending 50% of their time, like an entrepreneur does, raising money, right? Mm. So what I decided is I said, okay, well, there's got to be a better way I can help. I've done 12 businesses, well, now 14 businesses. I had two exit this year already. But that's a lot of companies and 100% success rate. And everybody is always like, holy crap, that's amazing. I can't believe it. So I said to myself, all right, well, if that's the case, maybe if I give this to people that have an idea and need the ability to ideate their idea and then do something with it. So when I studied the five reasons why they fail, 50% of them fail after they leave an accelerator. Well, that told me that an accelerator is basically like going to high school and you need a master's program. And BOSS was the master's program. So my concept was, well, what if I gave this to the accelerators to give to all these new entrepreneurs that are coming in, right? That was one idea. The second idea is to start this academy. And certain people will get, you know, grants to go to the academy, and it'll cost them nothing at all, right? So they have the ability to say, I have an idea, now what do I do? And the academy will guide them to that end. So it's, you know, the way BOSS works is there's five levels of a business. There are five reasons why businesses fail, and there are five levels in BOSS, and there are five rounds. Five is everywhere. So the first thing it does is it creates a North Star. And the North Star is, where are you going? So if building a business was like going from one location to another, you have to have directions, which means it has to start with where you are and where you're going. And most people don't do this. Most people just start building a business. Some people find a problem and then create a solution and then build a business. But all of those people, the majority of those people don't plan for the exit itself, the liquidity event, what happens down the line, which changes people's financial future. You have to plan for that up front, because when a company buys another business, the majority of the time, the reason why they're buying that business is to increase what's called their CAC to LTV ratio. So their customer acquisition cost to lifetime value ratio. They've already paid for the customers, they own them. So they need to make more money with the existing customers. So they buy other products, they buy other companies to sell to the same customers. So if you don't plan for that when you start, you could be building your business for years and turn around and be like, oh, okay, I'm going to sell my business on a synergy, which is what I'm explaining, and those are the highest multiples. And then there's no ideal customer profile on either side matchup, in which case they're not going to acquire you. And so now you spend all this time diluting, raise this money, the capitalization of the companies there, and a lot of them go out of business because of this. It's like building a product without a customer. Right, building a business without having a buyer is like building a product without. You have to do the research. And so the North Star spends a lot of time on planning the path of your business, where you're going to be, what success looks like, defines a lot of things, picks the buyers of your company so you can build something for that customer, aka acquirer of your business. And then it goes into strategy, which is how do you execute this process? And then it goes in, or you know, it's a plan, I should say. And then it goes into the execution stage, which is actually doing the work itself, standardization, which standardizes what you've learned, and then Kaizen, which is continuous improvement based on the standards that you've already documented, which increases things. So there's a lot of people don't understand this because they haven't been. It's like I learned this the hard way, and a lot of this stuff I created. The businesses, there are three value drivers. When I say value drivers, I mean valuation drivers. That are fundamental: growth, margin, and retention. Margin goes to the operations of the business in ICP. So again, ideal customer profile. Growth says people want to buy your product. This particular customer wants to buy your product. And retention says they're going to keep buying your product over time. These things allow you to start with understanding what your business should look like in terms of what the goal is. So you can start tracking it. All of this stuff that I'm talking about right now are things that if you put it in the right hands of the right people that are smart, these people will be very successful.
Hey everyone, this is Joe, just reminding you to check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. where you can find and explore all of the content that we've released under the EdUp Experience brand, including multiple podcast series, EdUp Elites, EdUp Embedded, and EdUp Experts. You can also suggest topics or guests for our podcast. Then head over to YouTube, check out our channel, The EdUp Experience, and you're going to find that my amazing co-host, Elizabeth Leiba, has started a new web series called EdUp Unplugged, where she talks about racism in America with special guests coming on that web series. We've got a lot going on at The EdUp Experience. Again, check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. Now let's get back to our guest.
What you see is you see this world of entrepreneurs, which is relatively young, right? You think about how long has this whole startup ecosystem been going, and then you think in that time frame, the U.S. did 112 unicorns last year, right? So you have $112 billion companies created by a culture, being the United States, of people that are creative people. We don't make things anymore. That's China and Mexico and all over the world. We create the things that get made. And so incubating an environment of entrepreneurs is the best thing we can do for the country and the people in it. Entrepreneurs in particular raise money from incubators and accelerators because they don't have it. So if you make them successful, you're doing wealth distribution. And so that is the focus.
So Greg, how can we apply those? And I'm sure Joe's going to want to jump in as well. But how can we apply those lessons in everything that you said? I'm going to like kidnap you because I could listen to this all day. How can we apply these messages and these lessons in higher education? Joe and I talk about this all the time, the idea, Greg, that higher education is not agile enough. A higher education, we've seen this with COVID, is not moving quickly enough to meet the needs of our customers. How can we not only translate these messages and give these messages to students that need to get these messages and these lessons in their hands, but also apply these lessons ourselves so that we can be more agile in this ever-changing, internet-infused world that we're all growing into?
Yeah, so I mean, I use BOSS. I mean, so let me give you, I did a TED Talk a few weeks ago, and I'm going to give you the subject of this TED Talk because when I did it, I was like, okay, well, now the cat's out of the bag. So I am an autistic, dyslexic person with processing disorders, and I also have asthma, okay? But I've done everything I've done, and I've done it using BOSS. I ran a marathon with asthma. I rode a bicycle from San Francisco to L.A. with asthma. I mean, what my life has been is to prove to people that you can do things that you think you can't do, and that's the beginning of everything, is people that are in areas like where I grew up, in special ed, thinking you can't do anything, and you know, here I am doing everything. And that is the beginning, I think, of everything, is just to make sure that you can do it. These universities have the ratchet effect. In politics, they call it the ratchet effect, which is every time something gets put in place, they don't reset the ratchet, they go from where that was on, and they layer and layer and layer. So it becomes very difficult to weave through all the history that's been there and consolidate things, because they just add stacks on top of stacks. I think the beginning place is for the United States to say, first of all, look, let's stick a stake in the ground. We are going to be the country of startups. We are going to be the country of visionaries, and we're already on that path. I mean, the internet came out of the United States. iPhones came out of the United States. Tesla came out of the United States. I mean, you know, it's everywhere. Jeff Bezos and Amazon, the United States, Pinterest, Facebook, Twitter, you could go on and on, right? Mm-hmm. This is who we are, right? Those ideas can come from more diverse people. Mm-hmm. The difference is that a lot of these ideas come out of universities that are Ivy League universities that are really expensive or very difficult to get into when you're in a neighborhood like Oakland. It's not like you're getting in a freaking Stanford. You know, they got 50 kids in a room and, you know, you're going to get beat up in between classes. I mean, shit's rough, right? So you have to make sure that you understand that these people don't have the same pathway to that higher education as other people in the first place. And community colleges don't have the same level of passion. So there's an adjustment, just a fundamental adjustment to that. And the understanding that just because, like in my scenario, just because you're growing up, you know, with special needs or special, you know, disabilities or learning disabilities, whatever they want to call it these days. I've heard everything over the last, you know, I'm 52, so I've been beat up over this stuff for long enough to know they just keep changing the names, but the things are the same. A lot like people of color, you know, they just keep doing the same thing. They just change the name. But, you know, it's a fundamental shift itself, right? To say, listen, we need to invest in these people because these people, they have the passion to change the world. You don't see the friggin' 1% building businesses because they have the outcome of what a business does. You see the people that are trying to make shit happen build the business, and what they're trying to make happen is make the country and the world a better place. And it comes from a place of passion, and it comes from a place of not having been very many alternatives. Those people are the hardest working, most passionate people. They're doing everything because this is it's not like it's sink or swim. You know, so when people, I think, understand this fundamental difference between the kind of energy and results you're going to get from one group of people over another group of people, they will make a bigger investment into this other group, you know, these other groups of people. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Say it louder for the people in the back, Greg. I got you loud and clear for sure. Thank you so much for that.
You know, Greg, when you're talking about investments and you're talking about access and wealth distribution and all of that, you know, one way to get increase access to education, to resources is through technology. And you're at the forefront of this. You're investing, you're selling businesses, you're watching these things happen. Obviously, with COVID, and you know what's happening with higher education today is there's this massive shift to online learning. You know, X University opens. X University has 400 cases of COVID now. In the fall, X University closes, tries to reopen again in a week. We're going to get more infections and close again. This may be going on for a while. So there's been a massive investment in ed tech, educational technology. And this may be something that resonates with you, maybe not, but I have to ask a question. Are you seeing that happen out there? Is there talk amongst the VC community that ed tech is this, you know, space right now to move into as fast as possible because of this disruptive nature of COVID on traditional higher education?
It's actually really interesting because it was already in motion. And the reason why I believe that is because I look at probably, you know, between 100 and 200 different deals a month, right? So I spend a lot of my day just looking at decks and businesses and things like this. And what I notice is that there's been this huge increase of ed tech companies across the spectrum. There's all, you know, younger kids and college and you know, special needs and just everything across the spectrum. It's crazy, the number of them. But you have to realize that those companies, typically a software company, takes between 2 and 3 years to get to the point where they're looking for money, where they can actually raise a Series Seed round, right? So there's pre-seed, seed, and Series Seed. So they're three rounds in, typically. These things are hitting my desk at Series Seed. That means that they were started before COVID. It would be impossible that – so what's happened is they have just gotten a lot of traction, which helped them speed up. They were already in development, which means that this trend was already going, especially in Asia where they've already had things like this happen. So I think that the progress of this is just, it's just speeding up. There are more, but I don't think it's because people are just starting them. I think it's because people are just moving a lot faster because they're able to get, you know, investors are throwing, you know, a lot of, I don't do this, but a lot of investors just throw money at a whole bunch of different things and hopes that something will stick. I'm very selective about the few that I actually do because every one of them sticks. But I have seen a shift in that, and there's a ton of them out there, and they're taking different approaches, and they're going after different verticals. So I have seen that. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, you know, like in every industry, there is some sort of disruption. So think a drop of water hitting a still lake. And then there's all the rings that come on the outside. The rings that are the closest to the drop are, you know, the first mover advantage folks. they create opportunities that create opportunities, each one of these things then becoming new rings, as if you had four drops hit a pond at the same time. And what I've noticed is that this is just the very beginning, because you're starting to see a lot of things happening also in businesses. So to your point earlier, you think about the fact that this work from anywhere thing. So you've got Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, you know, Salesforce, a lot of these big giant companies out of the Valley, you know, the Silicon Valley and all the way up to San Francisco, you know, that whole corridor are now saying you can work from anywhere. Well, what does that mean? That means you can't collaborate in the office. A lot of business happens when people walk through the hallways and when people hit a conference room for 10 minutes. And that's not there anymore. So you see that kind of software also being adapted for corporate environments as well. You know, you see this kind of shift happening, right, where you see educational software start to be repurposed for more than one thing. And obviously there's a trend for this, somewhat temporary, Zoom's, you know, success is not permanent. It's a temporary. We'll see how long they can hold on to that. But a lot of these things are starting to incorporate those sort of tools. So I think that the trend will continue in that route with educational software. I think that there's going to be a few survivors, like in the rest of it. There's going to be, you know, there'll be a handful of companies that will make it out of that. And then I think some of them will adapt to certain specific verticals. Those that I've seen that try to compete across the spectrum, I don't think are going to be successful. I think you need to say, listen, this is high school. This is university. This is junior high school. You know, this is for kids, you know, in grade school. Instead of saying this is learning software, right? It's not the same.
Right. That's a really interesting perspective. And, you know, you're right. I mean, ed tech has obviously had its time in the sun up to this point, and then and obviously it's been accelerated. And, you know, whenever you take something and move it from A to B, either by force or by choice, there are new ripples that become created, and people can build businesses. Really, Salesforce is a really good example, right? Salesforce creates this platform, mm-hmm. and then how many businesses have sprung to just attach onto that one platform? And, you know, higher education, though, traditionally is adverse to ripples and change. Mm-hmm. We fight it. And, you know, you said something, I'm getting there. Liz knows I do these long buildups.
I love.
Yeah, right. Yeah, thanks, Liz. but you said growth, margin, retention.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, man, that's totally the way I think. Right. Mm-hmm. In higher education, mm-hmm. though, not a lot. I'm going to say I might get some feedback for this one if I say it, but a lot of people in higher education don't think in those terms.
Yeah.
That higher education is not an industry. It's not a business. You know, the student is not a customer or consumer. Mm-hmm. Do you think, from your view, that growth, margin, and retention apply to any business in any context?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, think about it. If you got the taco shop down the street and they have less customers, what does that mean about their company, about their products, about their services and their food, right? If they aren't growing, what does that mean, right? They are indicators, and the ultimate indicators are financial indicators. Now, they're lagging indicators, which means that there's so much, whatever turned those numbers actually happened like 6 months ago. Those things that happened 6 months ago are leading indicators to the lagging indicator, which is the financials. But nonetheless, I think everything is a business because the patterns are the same, right? There is want and there is need. So there are businesses that it's turning into now a bear market, right? So in a bear market, businesses that succeed are those businesses that save money. In a bull market, businesses that succeed are usually businesses that make money. And so like calculate that across, you know, in higher education too. You could do the same thing and you could say, okay, are we having growth and where is the growth coming from? So in business, you have existing growth and you have new growth. You don't just have growth. And you have the revenue growth and customer growth. You don't just have growth there either, right? So if you're in higher education and the students that you're seeing are new and existing, you separate that. And then you separate the concept of the the revenue number, the amount of money they're paying for school versus the number of students, you can see the holes that the universities have in their programs. And I know, because I go to these places and I talk to them and I'm looking at the audience and I'm like, they're all white people. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? Right? Like, you know, it's like 90% white people. I'm like, do you guys not look at the freak, like, just walk around the campus. I mean, you know, I mean, like, you think that that would be something that you would find in your indicators and go, well, we right. have a huge untapped customer base. If you're a university, right? We have a huge untapped customer base. How do we make this more accessible? Right? How do we make this more accessible for the larger group of people that can then stimulate what our country is made out of, which is the entrepreneurial, creative, visionary spirit?
Well, and you know, one of the most fascinating things that's for us in higher education, I'd say fascinating for us in higher education, but I'm sure you see it too, you know, as schools, colleges, universities, what have you, is they're all moving online. That means that your customer, your student, does not have to choose you anymore. If you're in, I don't know, pick a state, New Jersey, and you were thinking about going to a New Jersey community college because you live 2 to 3 miles away from where that community college is, you could technically go to a community college in Oregon if you want to, because that community college in Oregon has moved to online courses, can offer you the same exact courses your community college in New Jersey can offer you. And if you're okay with missing out on drive time and back and forth to your New Jersey-based community college, you can go anywhere you want. And so schools are getting around to that online, competing in an online space, right? When you're talking about tech and you're talking about companies bought and sold over the internet, when you're competing in an online space, it is not the same as trying to dominate a local physical market. And, you know, can you talk about that just a little bit of, what competition, you know, how you say it like this, competition when you're in a physical 50 mile radius and you're competing for a student to choose you and come to your school is a totally different way of marketing and branding than when you're competing in an online space that is hyper competitive. And that's where higher ed is going. Just there are a lot of people that don't want to admit it. So what is that? What do you think about that? What do you think about what I just said?
I think that is extremely true. And I think culture is a big part of it. Like, I'll give you an example. So when I was coming up, right, and I didn't have, you know, I barely got out of high school, you know, I'm freaking like, you know, from a rough place where everybody's poor and, you know, there's less, you know, white people than other ethnicities. And then I go to like some university and walk around, you are intimidated as shit, man. You don't want to go to that school. You're just walking around going, I don't fit here, right? So culturally, you don't fit. But if you're online, you're in your own home. You're in your own area. You're feeling your own vibe, right? You're not like walking around a campus being intimidated by all these people that look like they're better than you. So I think that it gives these universities that are sort of like the underdogs, the benefit of saying, listen, you know, that whole college experience, you don't even have to have that whole thing. Because for some people, that's exactly what they want, right? For other people, it's like your personal nightmare. So, you know, I think that it'll add some cultural twist, and the universities need to capitalize on that, right? Say, listen, and create an environment that's more accessible, culturally accessible for people that feel uncomfortable going to a school where everybody seems like they're, you know, the straight A student out of the Hamptons or something, you know? And I think that's part of it. The other part of it is that I think that the universities, and there's some of them are starting to do this. I've noticed some of them starting to, like, when I'll speak to the business school at some university and they'll have like an entrepreneurship program. And those entrepreneurship programs are really good for them. But they're being taught by the teacher is teaching that something they have no business teaching. They've never built a company. They've never invested in a company. And if they have, they're a one-hit wonder, right? They did it once. They caught a wave. They landed it. But they can't go out and they catch another wave. And they become an instructor. And those are not the people we want teaching this generation of entrepreneurs. We need to be taking the best teaching the best. It's like they say in business. If you hire an eight, they're going to hire a seven. And pretty soon you're going to end up with a bunch of ones.
That's interesting. Well, and, you know, a lot of times, to your point, a lot of times, is particularly with programs that move quickly. Digital marketing is a really good example. You have faculty teaching a digital marketing, you have curriculum about digital marketing. Next week, digital marketing can completely change. Look at TikTok. It changed the entire landscape of social media and digital marketing in a really quick amount of time. And then your curriculum's old and your faculty doesn't understand it. And, you know, entrepreneurship sounds like it's in the same vein as that, where, you know, 2 years from now, entrepreneurship looks completely different than it did 2 years beforehand. And who's teaching it? And what's the curriculum look like? Those are things in higher education that we deal with, of updated curriculum, right? It's expensive to update curriculum. There's a pride of ownership at traditional universities for faculty to own that curriculum versus, let's say, more flexible online universities that do it more in a collaborative sense, and the university owns it, they can move more quickly. But those are all things that we think about in higher ed. And it's a real question of, it's a future question for us and how we adapt curriculum for the workforce, for entrepreneurship, for the skills that people who are out of work right now, and there are many, the skills that they need to become employable. Entrepreneurship represents a good entry back into the workforce if you know how to do it. So, you know, that kind of brings me to my question, and Liz will ask our last couple here, but, you know, how can BOSS help a college or university, or can it? Is it applicable in, you know, for a university who's struggling, trying to take the next step, you know, to grow their market? Is BOSS something they can call you about and say, hey, how can this help me?
So there's skill versus will, right? And so entrepreneurs have will, but they don't necessarily have the skill, and they may have subject matter expertise. A lot of times an entrepreneur comes out of some other industry and they have some subject matter expertise. I have one of my investments was a maintenance guy at a wastewater treatment plant. And he figured out that the more air they put into the wastewater treatment plant, the more bacteria thrived and the more waste they could chew up, which means they don't have to build more waste treatment plants. And if you think about the impact of that, and you're in a big city, we're talking about digging up miles and miles and miles of pipes to build one where there isn't a city because the city is developed around the treatment plant. And this guy had subject matter expertise, but he didn't know how to build a business. BOSS helped him with that. You know, so the guy's now successful, right? It's in a whole bunch of wastewater treatment plants. The thing is getting ready to sell. So there was another guy that we sold one in, I sold one in January. And, you know, this was a person that was familiar with public transportation, bus driving, okay? And found out from his perspective that when people get on a bus, it's distracting for the driver, and the driver's having a hard time looking around, making sure he's safe. The doors are closed. People are sitting down. There's not a bicycle in front of them, or somebody stepping off the curb, and there's a lot of distractions. Plus, the stopping at bus stations where there was nobody there, and it being frustrating for the people, you know, coming on board saying, hey, you know, I've been waiting here 45 minutes, you know. So he created an app that made it so you could pay with your iPhone getting on the bus, and then the buses knew when people were getting on, where they were getting on and off, and the bus driver didn't have to look to see if people were paying. It would just ding, ding, ding when they walk on. That company sold for $48 million in January, right, to the largest transportation company on the planet. That's another example. So if those two people didn't know how to take what they had as an idea and develop it into a business, they wouldn't have been successful. The problem is that doesn't exist outside of BOSS. That's why I decided to make it public, because there is no path to do that. There is no way to think about this. There needs to be something that a process that keeps you on the rails, right? When people go to school, they have a curriculum, and that curriculum drives them to an end result. And when you go into entrepreneurship, there's no curriculum. It's just go for it. And I'm trying to develop one so that these entrepreneurs have a path to lead them to success, and they understand what success looks like. Think about this. When people go to school, they say, what do you want to major in? So they know what they want to major in, and they know if they want to get a master's or a bachelor's, and they have a path to do that. That doesn't exist for entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurs are the best hope we have for employing people that can't get into, you know, expensive universities. It's the best hope we have as a country to compete in a global environment, especially when we've lost our edge with things like manufacturing, you know, to China and Korea, you know, all over Asia, South America, you know, so on and so forth, right? It's all about that process. This is the future of our country, and I think the universities would be served well to recognize that as an opportunity. And the problem that exists, which is obvious because 90% of entrepreneurs fail. I mean, what else do you need to know? How do you not see that and go, there's a problem there? Well, problems are opportunities. Universities teach, right? So how could you see this problem and then say, hey, we have the infrastructure already here to solve this problem, and then take advantage of that, create an opportunity, and do so much good in the process?
Can you, you're a visionary, you're definitely a futurist, you have a lot of insight into technology and what that can do to improve our lives in terms of education, in terms of business, in terms of our country. What do you see as the future of higher education, and what can we do to, what are some of your observations as far as what that future is going to look like?
Like, here's the bottom line, right? We all have the same brain, right? We all have the same hardware, you know?
Yes.
It's the software that's different. But you write software, and you use software. So that's where we all start, right? Women, black, white, Asian, Mexican, you know, whatever, right? We have the same hop. Our software works a little differently. So we have to become masters of understanding what we're actually, I mean, what are we trying to create? AI, robots, we're literally trying to invent ourselves, right? So why don't we focus on what we already have, which is ourselves, and figure out how to optimize what we are and across, you know, every brain, regardless of the body it's in. You know, that I think is the start. And the best service anybody in higher education can do is to find people and help them write their software mm-hmm. to better the world and better the country and even their local areas. So I just wanted to say that to start out with.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, with regards to higher education, you know, I think that the concept of understanding first what we need as a society and then teaching towards those needs is more important than being stuck on the old patterns that we have done for 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're a young country compared to the rest of the world, right? A few hundred years, pretty young, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Well, let's see, we came to, it's more than that because genocided all the Native, we fought the Native Americans for 300 years so
yeah.
until we made them extinct. But then, you know, the concept of having and sitting down and saying, okay, this is the job of higher education because they produce the future. To sit down and say, what do we need? We need sustainable energy. Let's put together programs for sustainable energy, right? There are the leaders, and every entrepreneur needs an executor. There is always a visionary and an implementer, right? You never see businesses where the one person does it all. There's always the visionary. They just have different patterns set up in their brain. They operate differently. You know, the software runs differently. So you're training two types of people. You're training the executor, you know, implementer person who's going to sit down and do it, and the visionary, the big brain thinker out into the future and that sort of stuff. And so what if we said we have to create a new industry, we have to take advantage of sustainable energy. It's called sustainable for a reason, right? And then we have programs for sustainable energy instead of programs for a bachelor's. I can't tell you how many entrepreneurs that I talk to on a daily basis and they're like, yeah, I got a bachelor's. And I'm like, how's it working? You know, I ask them, I'm just curious. I'm like, so how did that help you? And they go, it doesn't, I mean, I understand things. I learned things that I didn't know before, but I could have learned those things on my own. But with regards to building my business, not at all.
Hmm.
And how many universities track the courses and the majors that students took and then ended up going a different route? How many people said, I want to be a speech and language pathologist, or I want to be a psychiatrist or something like that, and ended up going a completely different route? Do universities track that to see how successful they are with what they're doing? I don't think so. I haven't seen it. None of the people I've talked to have seen it. So how are you supposed to, you know, create iterations to improve and evolve over time if you're not even looking at the success you've had in the past?
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com. And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen in live and get the scoop before anyone else does. So, please, as always, feel free to share this podcast. Rate, review, and subscribe. We would really, really appreciate that. You've been listening to The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Liva, and Elvin Freitas.